Okay, folks, should we get started? Now, last time, which was Monday, I concluded by asking you a question, and I said I'd ask you for the answer on the Friday. So, who can remember the question? Well, I'll repeat the question. Maybe the answer would be easier. So last week, not last week, on Monday we talked about clustering and we briefly described agglomerative methods, which are also known as hierarchical clustering. And then we focused mostly on the k-means algorithm, which is a divisional type of clustering where you fix a priori the number of clusters you expect, and then you partition your data into such a number of clusters through an iterative algorithm. The question was, what is the complexity of agglomerative, of hierarchical clustering, and what is the complexity of k-means? So what's the big O of the algorithm? I thought it would be just a nice thing to do to, you know, try to see the connections between the two things. We do care, even in learning, we care about the things that they teach you in the ADS thread, because they're useful things. You know, if you can immediately say, actually, this approach to modeling the data will not work if I have a million data points, that's a valid point of, you know, you're just going to look for something else. Okay, so let me refresh you very briefly what you need to do in both cases. Okay, so we have, the idea is the usual. We have some data. We wish to cluster it. And we have the hierarchical approach, which basically computes all the distances, so stores in a matrix all the distances, J. And then what you would do, so in this case you would find, for example, the two closest ones are these ones. You display them at the bottom. You link the two closest ones, and you replace them with a fictitious data point in the middle, and then you iterate and grow a tree in this way. Let's say you get something like this, and then you get something like this, and you would get that there are two groups very strong of small distances between them, and then there are the two groups are very far from each other. So this is the hierarchical approach. While the agglomerative, partitional approach, the k-means, let's say, you initialize k points that are your candidate means, m1 to mk, then you compute the distance between mk and your data point I. You assign points to the closest mean, and then you update the mean by moving it to the empirical mean or the points that have been assigned to it, and so on and so forth. What's the algorithmic complexity of the hierarchical approach? N cubed. Why N cubed? Right, okay, so a priori that's good, but we can do better. We can do it we can do it down to n squared, because essentially when you replace two points with one, you don't have to recompute every single distance. Okay, so you're right, we're going to compute these n times, but most of the distances we have computed already. So this is n squared. Anything that involves computing things pairwise, it's going to be n squared, at least. What about this? Exactly. which that's one interesting fact. There is one element there that we don't know, number of iterations. Okay. And that's actually something that you cannot do, know a priori. So a lot of algorithms in machine learning, particularly iterative algorithms, and you will see a lot if you're interested in that, you can't a priori say this is the number of iterations. In general, what you can say is that in k-means, the number of iterations tends to be reasonably small. So if you have to cluster a million data points, that's not going to start. This may get you somewhere. So that's one reason why we spent a lot of time talking about k-means and not so much about hierarchical clustering, despite the fact that hierarchical clustering has a lot of attractive features. For example, you don't have to determine the number of clusters a priori. Okay? So that's a useful digression, and it shows you how, actually, in practice, the algorithms and data structures thread can be useful, not only in pre-processing the data and storing and answering queries and so on, but also in helping you to determine, you know, whether what you're doing is sensible at all. Now, the other thing that I asked you towards the end of the last lecture was whether you found it interesting or useful to kind of implement things on the go. And that's, I haven't had any answers about that, I have to say. But, you know, you can pass them on to the class reps, and they'll tell me at the student-staff liaison at the end of the course when it won't be useful anymore, or you can tell me. So, do you find it useful to see how to implement things, very easy things, not particularly useful, quite useful? Well, there you go. It's good to get a definite answer out of people. So never mind. We'll see. What happens this lecture is that the algorithm we're going to look at is so easy that the implementation is somewhat trivial. Okay, so today we're going to look at classification, and particularly we spend some time about the k nearest neighbor. Yeah. I'll switch off some lights. That may be beyond me. Now, it says medium. What if I do low? That's certainly brighter here, but what I don't know is how to switch these off and keep those bright, which may be the ideal. Is this fine otherwise? Okie doke. So we look at k-nearest neighbor classification, and then we look, well, we won't look really in detail. We just define the concept of what a generative model is, okay? Now, classification, in common parlance, classification and clustering may seem to be closely related concepts. Okay? And in fact, you may as well say instead of clustering things, you may say that you classify them. But in machine learning, they're quite distinct. There are obvious connections between the two concepts, but they're quite distinct. And the main distinction is tellingly pointed out by using italics here. Okay? So now your data, each data point in classification, well, first of all, the data is divided into two sets. You're given some supervision, which means you're given a particular special set of the data, which you call training data. And this consists of pairs of a feature vector, which can be whatever it wants, and a label. Okay? A label is usually one out of C possible classes. As I said, first of all, you get given a training data set. So you get given a portion of the data from which you know the true labels. The goal is to perform learning on this. So a classifier typically is an algorithm that has got some freedom in it. And it could be that freedom is some parameters, as we will see in the kind of the generative models and we'll see further on, or the freedom is in where you place the appropriate boundaries and so on. But whatever you do, with the training data, you learn your model. So you learn where you're going to put the boundaries between classes. That's also called training a classifier. And then what you want to use the classifier for is a test set. Okay, so a test set is a subset of the data where you have the features, but you don't have the labels. So do you want to come up with examples of situations where you may have pairs of features and labels? Okay, where you may have a learning algorithm in your mobile phone or in your computer, for sure. So let's take emails. So each email is a string, a collection of words, I guess, at the most basic. You can look at it as a collection of words. I think I mentioned it already that in this way you can build a feature representation from text, okay, basically counting how many times a certain word happens and putting that number in a very large vector. And then you may have some data points which you label as spam and some data points which you don't, well, you label not spam, essentially. And then in an email program, you may want to have a classifier that, whenever new emails arrive, automatically labels them as spam or not. Or you may want to allow a third option in which it says essentially not sure and flags it up as possible spam, but doesn't automatically throw it away as spam. There are other manifold possible examples. In fact, almost everything, you know, you can attach a label to, and almost everything comes with features. So, for example, you know, biometrical features of people and class them as male or female. If you have an automatic vision systems, you may want to do that. A key concept which is essential in the training phase is the idea of an error function. At its most basic, an error function could be how many times do we make an error when classifying. Now, there is an obvious problem here that, well, okay, maybe when we train the model, we could train it not to make any errors, but then what we're interested in is the generalization performance. So how well does it do on a test set? And, you know, if we use our test set, then that's it. If we also use our test set to optimize the performance, then we're not doing very well. So there are various ways to address this problem. One way is to have a function that is not directly the number of errors, but it's something like the fit of the model to the training data. We see that in the case of generative models. Another option is to use what is called cross-validation. So you take your training set and you just train on a subset of that and use the rest to see how well you are doing and tuning your parameters in order to optimize there. These are slightly more advanced topics, but you know, they don't really appear in what we'll talk about today, but they're important. Now, the example that I'm going to show you some pictures about is much more mundane than the email spam. But it is a perfectly feasible example. You know, you have a big fruit packaging. I don't know, you're making fruit juice in an industry and you don't want to have a person to count exactly. You want two pears and one apple for every tropical mix. So you need some automated way of labeling fruits as pears and apple. And you can measure some characteristics, for example, the diameter or the circumference in an automated way. And you may have some training data whereby you have, say, now which way would it go? This is the circumference and this is the height. So pairs tend to be higher, not always, but usually. So I would expect the triangles to be the pairs and the blue blobs to be the apples, which in fact are quite wide but not so tall. So this may be our training data. In this case, it's numerical. We only measure two features, and we can plot them one against the other. It's always useful to have two-dimensional examples to teach on. And then we could get a new test point. So we get a new piece of fruit, and we measure, say, using a laser, the diameter, hence the circumference, and the height, and we place it here. Now, of course, it would be very easy for us, looking at the picture, to conclude that that is very probably a pear, while this example, we conclude very probably would be an apple. Of course, there may be some more ambiguous examples, particularly there may be examples where we don't have much data. So if we've got something here, well, what is it? Is that going to be? So this is the kind of cartoon that we bear in mind for two-dimensional data, where you don't need very sophisticated methods usually. But in higher dimensions, we may want to have an automated way to do it. So what is one possible approach? One possible approach is to come up with what is called the decision boundary. Okay? So for example, we could say, let's draw a line in this two-dimensional space to partition pears from apples. Okay? In this case, for example, a line is determined uniquely by two parameters, which is its slope and its intercept on the y-axis. And what I could do is literally use the number of errors as my error function. Okay? So I could start drawing a line up here and say everything above it is pears and everything below it is apples. And I would make a lot of errors. Namely, I would get quite a lot of pears as apples, but I would make no errors in the apples. And then I could go down until I get to a region where I don't make as many errors. Of course, in this case, there would be a little bit of freedom because I can wriggle it about without changing the error function. One thing that is important about this type of error function is that, you know, suppose that my training data was patient survives, patient dies. Well, I want to get as few possible. You know, if there is a very different cost attached to make a mistake, you know, I'm happy to give the drug to some people that don't really need it as long as I catch everyone. So these kind of considerations can easily be built into this type of approach. But another thing that we would want to comment is that we clearly will not be able to get any lines that partition the data set optimally without making any errors. Okay? Now, what would be an obvious way to go beyond this simple example? So what would be an obvious way to improve on lines?
Curves.
Right. Any curves?
Square cubics,
yes. Well, let's take the any curves to start off with, because the any curves illustrates, and of course, I mean, I don't need to partition the space into only two regions, okay? I could say, you know, apples live here, but they also live here, if I had data that told me that, and there are some pairs in between. In general, you can construct at least data that would tell you that. Now, let's take arbitrary curves. Then probably what I would want to do is to make the boundary of the apples like this, and then go up a little bit and go down. Now, would that be a good solution? Whoa, give me zero error. So why is it not good? What do you want better than that? Sorry? No, we're not assuming any this big or this thick.
You have this precise curve, which basically says that there is no noise in the data. Not noise, but there are.
So what that would assume, if we had seen all apples and all pears that will ever be produced, then maybe that would be a sensible scenario, okay? Because then we really, you know, we have access to all future apples, and that's great. You know, we know how to minimize the error on all possible future apples. But the key point is this is a limited training set. And if we use a very complex model, so a general curve would have lots of parameters to tune. A line has only got two parameters, the slope and the intercept. But a general curve, you know, if you start having a cubic curve, well, you got four parameters, three coefficients, term 3, 2, 1, and then a constant. You would get soon into a situation where you can dramatically reduce your error on your training set by making your model very complex. But that is likely to give you a very bad generalization, because there is an overlap between apples and pears, and if you want to make it so precise that you go all the way up here and here, then there is likely to be pears that go wrong, okay, or apples that go bad. And that's an important point, besides the jokes. You want to have classifiers, you want to have algorithms, machine learning methods that generalize well, not that necessarily fit the training data well. So this we are looking here is only looking at fitting data. Now, another approach would be the non-parametric approach. Now, if you go into machine learning, you'll hear this word non-parametric a lot. In some sense, we saw it in clustering already. So the hierarchical clustering was a non-parametric method because we weren't optimizing any parameters. K-means was a parametric method because the position of the means were parameters that we were changing to obtain an optimal partitioning. So this is a parametric method because we have two parameters, the slope and the intercept, and we tune them to make the error function the smallest. But we could think of non-parametric methods. Okay? So we could think, never mind about having a boundary explicitly defined, I'm going to be a pair if I'm near a pair. Okay? And that makes a lot of sense. So we could be, if you are somewhere here, what you care about is not where is the decision boundary, it's just who are your nearest neighbors. If you're here, the nearest neighbors approach may give you some sort of problems as well, but it's at least it doesn't impose any preconceptions about where the boundaries should fall. And that's the idea of the nearest neighbor. Okay. The easiest example is look at your nearest neighbor, one single nearest neighbor, and you inherit the class from the nearest training point. Okay. The training points, at this moment, we don't do any actual training. We don't optimize anything over the training set. We just store them. And if we get a test set, we go through them, look at the distance of the test point from the training points, all of them, and label it like that. Or we can do slightly better. Well, I don't know. Is it any better? Do you think it's better to do k nearest neighbors or one nearest neighbor? There are advantages in k-nearest neighbors. K-nearest neighbor is the same thing, but instead of just retaining your one nearest neighbor, you look at the k that are closest to you, and then you make them vote. The majority wins. So if you've got seven nearest neighbors, four of them are apples, three of them are pears, you're going to be an apple. And the advantage of this, it is, yeah, question. Ah, right, if you have numerical data, that this could happen because of rounding errors, I guess. There isn't, I mean, it's not one aspect that happens so frequently to be worth mentioning, but there is a good point there. If you actually happen to be really equidistant between your two nearest neighbors, what that means intuitively is that you're going to make 50% of errors. Okay? So you may as well give it a label at random, not waste any time. So that's what people do. You can either just label it as apple and forget about it because it doesn't happen very often, or you can give it a random label. But in both cases, well, you're going to make 50% errors. Because, you know, 50% a priori will be pairs, or if you use a random labeling, 50% will be the different class. So, you know, it doesn't really make any difference. But it's a good question. You know, there are things can fall on the boundary, and if you started having, say, binary vectors as your features, then more things may fall in the boundary. In general, binary vectors, data with binary vectors are very high dimensional, so even in that case, it's a rare problem. But that could happen on the k-nearest neighbor case as well. So if I choose 8 neighbors, well, I get 4 of one type and 4 of the other type, I'm stuck. So what would be a sensible suggestion in that case? Right, so you can say, let's forget ever about this problem and use an odd number. That's a fair suggestion. Anyone has other suggestions? Add another neighbor for that particular point and see what's the vote. Yes, so that in some sense pushes us back to the next, to the same situation, except that it's a little bit better in the sense that you don't have to compute, say, 9 distances in all the cases. You only compute 8 distances, and only in those particular cases where there is a tie, you compute the 9th one. So that's a good suggestion. Right, so you could start looking at the ranking, okay? So if I were in a situation, say, let's go back to this picture. Okay, let's say I was here. Okay, I've got 1 apple and 1 pear. Let's go to, but in a sense, if I extend the number of neighbors, then I would get more and more pairs because I'm towards the pear size. Or we could be in a situation, I don't know whether we can really get it here. Yes, let's put ourselves here and have 6 nearest neighbors, and then we're probably going to get these 6. 3 apples and 3 pears, but the 3 pears are much closer than the 3 apples, so that may be a sensible modification to the algorithm. You know, if there is a tie, look at which one, at the ranking. We're not going to do anything sensible today, so we'll just look at the basic algorithm, okay? But it's good to think about, you know, what if. That's the attitude that, you know, the researcher has. You know, you get given something and you start thinking, well, what could go wrong and how can I make it better? So as I was saying, training k-nearest neighbors is trivial. You just store the training set. But testing is less trivial. Well, it is trivial as well. But you need to find who are the nearest neighbors. Okay? So there is no training involved in nearest neighbors. You just store the training points. When you get a test point, then that's when you start working. Okay? You have to find the nearest neighbor and then the nearest training examples. And this can be computationally demanding if you have 1 million data points, and if you're looking at taking 1,000 training points, for example, 1,000 nearest neighbors. But in general, it has to be said that k nearest neighbors is a very cheap classifier, and actually, in many cases, it's a surprisingly effective classifier. It is something that, you know, was discovered 20 years ago, so we people in machine learning discount it, but actually, it works quite well if you have a practical problem. Now, again, sometimes you may be luckier. So in some cases, you know, it may be obvious that you don't need to compute all the distances with all the other points. Okay, you could know somehow that you are on one side of the data set, so you just want to compute a smaller number of distances. And there are data structures that help you doing that. But that's not always a guarantee. Okay? So this would be an example of classifying with k-nearest neighbors. If we're given this test set, test point, doesn't matter how many k neighbors we take, basically, unless any reasonable number of k will do. By the way, what's a reasonable number of k? That's another very good question. I mean, as I said, k nearest neighbors works well, but what is a good k? There isn't really a good way of finding out that, actually, as far as I know. It's not like k means that we could potentially plot the error for various values of k. I don't think there is such a thing for k nearest neighbor. Obviously, we don't want to take k equals to the size of the training set, because then we always get that we have, you know, as many apples as pears in the k nearest neighbors. Heuristics are what you could use. Or you could fix it by, what I was saying, cross-validation, taking some part of the training set apart and see how well you do for various values of k. So in this case, basically, for any reasonable number of k, here we have 20 apples and 20 pears, so for, say, 5, 10 even, we'd get a pear. Similarly, here we get an apple. Here we get a more curious case, okay? Because in this case, we would get one situation where one nearest neighbor would give you a different result from three nearest neighbors, for example. One would say pear, three would give you apple, four would give you a tie, five would probably give you pear, and anything more than that would almost certainly give you an apple. So, not always the cleanest of algorithms. I mean, there are things that can go bad. So that was the example I was pointing out. One nearest neighbor, pair, two nearest neighbor, three nearest neighbors, you get apple. Five nearest neighbors, you get pear again. And then you get apple. Okay, so this is the k nearest neighbor algorithm. We could implement it in MATLAB if you wanted to. I have MATLAB window open. But I guess people really don't. There are some people that are threatening to disembowel themselves in front of the class, and that's not something I would like to see. So it's totally trivial, okay? That's why I was happy to implement it as well. Just store the test data. Storing the test data means store the positions and store the labels. Okay? Labels is given as the vectors of all zeros except 1, 1, which is in the right position. And then you compute the distance between test point and each training point. You then select the k nearest training examples. And you have your loss function here, which basically says, you know, how many of their how many neighbors are in a certain class, and you find which value gives you the maximum. So the largest number of that function. Okay. In that case before that we saw, we had that our function L, in that rather formal definition, could take two values, number of pairs, number of apples. And given a certain number of neighbors, we would get, say, in this case, where we choose 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 neighbors, we would get pairs 3, apples 6, classify as apple. Now, this formula may seem a little bit formal, but it's useful. And why is it useful? Okay, why do I want to write such a rather formal formula for doing something as trivial as k nearest neighbors classification? And we said why already, so you know. We've already discussed why is a good idea. Okay, because if I have this formula, I can start saying, okay, instead of putting in the first column, okay, so I had the situation where, let's say in the apples pairs case, I would have my function which has, oops, stop there. Okay, I would have a function, this is a function number of pairs, number of apples, and I've got 3, 6, So it just counts how many pairs pop in. Well, I could do something else. I could do, for example, sum of 1 over the distance between the test example and the pairs. And sum of 1 over the distance between the apples, the apple and Z, the test point, OK? So if things are near, then I weigh them more. So if I've got 3 pairs that are very near to me, I may even get a bigger number. So these are the reason why this is useful, and I'm writing it down, is not only that I'm obsessed with mathematics and I really like mathematics. It's also because it is useful. Because when you start thinking about how do I make this crappy algorithm a little bit better so that I don't assign something that is really near 3 pairs to the apples, because there are 6 very far apples, if you use that, you can just do it very easily. You just modify 1 line of code. Instead of putting the number of pairs, you put the sum of the inverse distances. And you have computed it already, because that's step 1. You compute all the distances, so you got that data. OK? That's k-nearest neighbors. Any questions? As I said, it's an intuitive algorithm. It's extremely simple to implement. It works remarkably well, usually. It falls in the non-parametric class because there isn't any parameters that we are really optimizing or tuning in the in finding the classifier. The one thing that you could call a parameter is the number of nearest neighbors, and that can be selected, say, by cross-validation. One thing that isn't clear so far, I've talked about classifications in terms of defining a decision boundary, so placing a geometric separation between the two classes so that the plane, in this case, or the space where my feature vectors live, is partitioned into 2 sets. If your test point comes into 1 set, it's in 1 class. If it falls in the other set, it's in the other class. So is there an analog between the k-nearest neighbors and the geometric point of view? And there is, okay? Because now just think, what is, let's think in terms of 1 nearest neighbor, which is the easiest way to look at it, okay? We want to find out what is the region in the plane that is closest to the blue dots, apples, or to the red triangles. Now, if I had only 1 point, then I would just draw a line between them. And that would tell me which one is easier, which one is closer. I would basically take the axis of the segment joining the 2 points. Now, what I can do is define what is the region of space that is nearest to this point. So let's start 1 versus all. We start with 1 point. Okay, then I have to be, if I'm on this side, I'm going to be nearer to this than to that, but I could be also nearer to this. So I'll draw another line, and I'll get a region of space basically to the right, to the left of this, and above this, where I'm certainly going to be nearest to this point. Now, the region of space where I'm going to be nearest to a blue point than a red point is the union of all the subsets of the space where I'm nearest to 1 of the blue points. Okay? So in practice, what I do, I connect each point to all the other ones, and I start drawing lines. And you see, this bit of space is where I'm nearest to this point. This bit of space is where I'm nearest to this point. This region of space is where I'm nearest to this point, and so on. Now I want to know the region of space where my 1 nearest neighbor would be blue. I have to take the union of all the regions of space for the blue points. Okay. And essentially, the geometric structure would be given. space. An important thing to notice is that we're still in a very simple type of geometry. So the parametric model that I proposed first was, you know, draw a line and draw the best line, optimizing two parameters. What one nearest neighbor does is to find a piecewise linear boundary, decision boundary. Because as you see, you know, it's a line, and then it joins another line, and so on and so forth. Right. Okay? This is an example of Voronoi tessellations for the more mathematically inclined of you. Now, working out exactly what's a decision boundary for two nearest neighbors is a lot harder. Okay, I'm not going to talk about that. So this is what I wanted to say about nearest neighbor classification. It does have an implied geometric structure, but it doesn't have a parametric representation of the data. So this is the type of approach that we have taken, is entirely data-driven. We just take the data. We don't assume anything more than the data. We don't assume the existence of, you know, distributions for the pear class and the apple class. And we just move on. To some extent, this doesn't have anything to do with modeling the data. Okay? We have not got a model of what a pear looks like. We just have some data if you are at the distance between the feature vectors. The alternative approach, which is what leads to the generative paradigm, is modeling data. So the generative model is called generative because we assume that there exists some mechanism through which the data is generated. Okay? So vectors that correspond to the pair class come from a certain probability distribution, for example. And this is a very useful approach, okay? Partly because, maybe not so much in the apples and pears case, but in many cases, we know something about the data, and we can construct something plausible about the data. So if our data is text, and we know that it's in English, we know something about the grammar of the, that there exists such a thing as grammar, and we can use that type of information to produce a better model of the data that gives us better results. So this essentially is a slide which recaps quite a few of the things that I've been saying. What we move on is the direction in which we're moving on is essentially we assume there is an underlying mathematical model that tells us which regions of space should be apples and which regions of space should be pears. And what this corresponds to a function, a discriminant function, for example. So a way of placing the boundary between the two regions. The function typically depends on some parameters. Now, all of these methods are going to be parametric. And the key assumption, the key hope, and what we aim to achieve is to use the training data on the function to obtain a value of the function, then we'll generalize well to new data. There are two approaches for this, both in the data modeling framework. One is the generative model. Essentially, we build a model for each class. This would be a probabilistic model, so it will say, if you are an apple, and you're here, if you're an apple, well, let's say you're going to be 17 by 5 centimeters, 17 centimeters of circumference and 5 centimeters of height, plus or minus some Gaussian noise. If you're a pear, you will be 15 by 8 plus or minus Gaussian noise. This would be a model of the pear and a model of the apple data. So for each class, we build a model. We have a separate model for pears and a separate model for apples. choose, once we have a model, we have essentially a way of scoring how well the model describes the data point. We compute the score for pear, we compute the score for apple, and we look at which one is higher. The discriminative modeling approach, he says, don't worry about modeling the classes independently. All you're interested in is modeling where the boundary falls. So the approach of placing a line would have been a discriminative approach. So, for example, what we would want to do maybe is to be able to discriminate images. Okay? Now, what would we do? We would take images to be vectors of pixels. Each pixel has got a color intensity, so each pixel would correspond to three intensities for the constituent colors, green, red, and blue. And we would have labels. Okay? This is an extremely hard problem, by the way. Classifying, you know, cows versus sheep from images is something that we humans are extremely good at doing. And although I guess sheep versus goats would be quite difficult in this case, but cows is easier. But a computer it's very hard for computers. It's even hard to come up with segmenting, so to finding out that there is a cow. It's an advanced problem in computer vision. But basically, what we would do if we were generating models, we would have a model of a cow, of what a cow looks like. Cows will look like having some features, so for example, some color intensities. From this data, we would probably say cows are red and white. And then, given a new image, we would look at how likely it is to be a cow, for example, by looking at how much red and white it has, or a sheep, or a goat. So we would generate a model for cows, a model for sheep, a model for goat, and this would give us, given a new pattern, the probability that that pattern was generated by the sheep model or by the cow model, and we would just look, basically, in the most basic form, we would look at which model gives the highest likelihood score. Obviously, each model would have some parameters. The parameters could describe, for example, the fraction of the image that we expect to be red, and we tune it according to the training set. So we would expect from this that maybe 10% of the image will be red if you have a cow. That would be a very simple model. So as I said, we have one model for cows, model sheep, model goats. Given a new image, X, which is a set of number for pixel intensities, we can compute the probability of X coming from the model cows, the probability of X coming from the model sheep, or of X coming from the model goats, and assign it to the highest one. Now, this may seem fairly you know, at the moment, fairly impenetrable to you. But actually, it's quite a good direction to go in. These are some issues that they exist with generative models. The first one is, of course, we need to know the model. And in the example I've just given you, I don't know what a generative model to generate cows images. Nobody knows what that is. Okay? It's a hard thing. So we need to come up with a sensible model. But there are many situations where we can come up with a sensible model. For example, if we have text, we may have a grammar-based model. Or if we have speech and we are looking at acoustic signals, we have a model of what acoustic signals look like for the different letters, for example. And once we have that model, you know, that would enable us to compute the likelihood score for each possible class, but it would still need to be a tractable model. Okay? So it would still need to be something that we can compute in a reasonable amount of time. And it would still need to be something that we can train with the amount of data that we have. So if we take a model, a generative model that involves tuning a million parameters, and we have 1,000 data points, that's not a good idea. So in general, people will err on the side of having easier models, simpler models, partly because they're more robust, but partly because they're more mathematically tractable, and because you don't run the risk of going around each pear and each apple and getting very bad generalization. Okay, so we got to the end today. We're going to look at these things a lot in the rest of the course. We'll look at classifications with Gaussians, for example, naive Bayes classification. All of these are methods that will use essentially simple statistical models to construct the classifier. So, points to take home from today. Classification is one example of supervised learning. You have some data where you're told by the supervisor how your algorithm should perform. You're told the true answer, the label, and you use this training data to learn your classifier. In some cases, you can use non-parametric models where the training is trivial, and as I said, they often have a good performance. And that's the case of k-nearest neighbor. Even these imply a geometric structure that partitions the space into two subspaces where corresponding to two classes. In practice, we've seen that one nearest neighbor may suffer from some problems. For example, if you happen to have an outlier pair in the middle of the apples and you get a new point that is near the outlier pair, you get it classified as a pair. Larger k give a smoother solution in some sense. Still, maybe it's the wrong solution, because maybe, you know, if you really like that pair, you are another pair. A problem that I've mentioned and I've dwelt a little bit, what matters in building a classifier is the generalization performance. So not how well it will do on the training data, but how well it will do on new data. And if you get complex models, any possible curve to draw the boundary, you risk the run of tuning so hard your classifier to the training data that it doesn't do so well on the test data. That's called overfitting. So simpler models, in some sense, are better because they don't run this risk. What we'll go on next week is to look at Bayes' theorem. So we'll start getting real serious with these generative models. Look at Bayes' theorem, which is a great tool where lots of people really love in the informatics forum, including myself. And we'll start working on statistical pattern recognition, so how to build generative models and how to handle them. So that's it for today, and I'll see you next Tuesday.
Tessellation.
So you'd get the average of the nearest neighbors.
But not necessarily two or four. You can pick as many as you.
So that's an example of a very closely related task, which is called regression, and that you can view all supervised learning as essentially learning a function between an input, which is your feature vectors, and an output. In a case of classification, the output is 0, 1, or a finite set of classes. In the case of regression, it's an integer, it's a value, a real value, color scale value, for example. And you can do nearest neighbor regression as well by saying, you know, you regress to what's your nearest neighbor. So you find in input space who's your nearest neighbor, and your output value would be that. But in the case of regression, what you people would tend to do, the averaging, still based on nearest neighbors. You find your nearest neighbors and you average their output value. And that tends to be more robust. So yeah, it is closely related, right?
And I guess it's quite easy to find the boundaries. So, for example, if you have something like you can do here, and if you color by using interpolation, if you color all this.